Well, we missed him last week, but he's here now, the wonderful Dennis Stewart. Hello.
Hello, Amanda. That's very nice of you to make those remarks.
Oh, we always miss you.
Very chuffed.
You're like a warm hug.
Oh, that's lovely. That's lovely.
Now, Dennis, during the year, you've discussed the role of specific foods to seriously address various health problems.
Yes.
This may have been a little bit controversial for some people, particularly health professionals. So first up this morning, or this afternoon, you want to introduce the concept of functional foods and then review some specific examples of functional foods.
Well put. Yes, look, I thought I'd start the program today just to introduce to listeners this concept that food is more than just something to fill the belly and keep us going. It does that, certainly. But food also, historically, has been used as a medicine. In fact, if you go back to the great Hippocrates, he made that statement that food is your best medicine. And all that we have been talking about with reference to certain foods is to emphasize this great view that goes back to antiquity, that the food we eat has profound potential as medicinal agents. So when we talk about functional foods, that's the modern term that's used in academic and nutritional and dietetic circles, increasingly that is, to explain the rationale of recommending or commending certain foods to people that are battling with certain diseases. Functional foods basically means foods that have a function medicinally and can be used not just as something to satisfy our appetite, but as something that can be used to help us fight particular disease processes. Functional foods, using particular foods to assist in fighting human disease.
Well, that'll be a lot of foods, I'd imagine, apart from maybe processed foods.
Oh, we're talking here, by the way, about food, genuine food, not the food that now has overwhelmed the Western world, and in my opinion, is responsible for the explosion in many diseases that as a child we never saw but are now so popularly experienced. The food that I'm talking about today is genuine tucker, food that we used to grow as younger people, food that's still there but not taken advantage of enough, particularly in certain areas around this country where we have fast food capitals that certainly, in my opinion, are the very contradiction of what I'm talking about when I'm talking about functional foods.
Well, I've opened a can of worms.
You have indeed.
Dennis's head you nearly exploded.
And look, this is not to say, now let's put it in perspective. This is not to say that I don't enjoy the occasional going out and having a Macca's. I enjoy that, particularly with the grandkids, and there's a role for that. But what I get distressed about is the way increasingly people are depending upon fast foods of all descriptions to not just be used as an enjoyable occasional thing, but as basically their standard food.
Yeah.
That worries me greatly.
Well, as we used to say in when I worked in preschool, fast food is a sometimes food.
Well, that's well put, and that's why I don't want to be seen as a wowser. I'm not. I have too many grandchildren and now exploding numbers of great-grandchildren. They will all, when they come to see my dear wife and myself, ask to go out to McDonald's or Henny Penny or one of these other great institutions, and that will happen. But at the same time, when they retreat, stay with us for the weekend, they will be introduced to real food, cooked by a real woman who knows how to cook well.
Diabetes is a disease experienced by many thousands of people around the world. One functional food is popularly used around the world to help manage the condition. And can you tell us about the food?
Yes, look, I can do that very easily, actually, because I have done a lot of research, particularly around the food that I'm going to talk about in a moment. But first of all, listeners need to appreciate that when we talk about diabetes, we're talking here about what's referred to as type 2 diabetes. We're not confusing it with type 1 diabetes, which is an autoimmune disease, and prior to the advent of insulin was almost a death sentence. No, we're talking about type 2, which is endemic in affluent countries, has a lot to do, I suspect, with dietary factors, with obesity and things like that. But there are a lot of thoughts associated with what is, if you like, characteristic of the causes of type 2. But good thing about it is, around the world, and I say around the world, there is one food which stands out as being well known, used frequently, and forms the basis of many delicious dishes which can easily be accessed via the net these days. And that food is popularly used in countries like India, South Asia generally, in South America, where it's eaten prolifically. And that food is known as bitter melon.
Oh.
Bitter melon. And the good thing about it is, before I start talking about its characteristics, bitter melon is a food that grows very easily in this country. And fortunately, as a result of people emigrating to Australia from countries where bitter melon is eaten and recognised for its health benefits, they bring the knowledge of how to grow that food here in Australia. And I mention that to some of our gardeners who might be interested in having a go at growing bitter melon. It grows prolifically. If you get it going, you'll be able to feed the whole of the neighbourhood with it, albeit many of them may not like the taste of it unless they look at some of the ways on how to prepare it. Now, bitter melon is botanically known as Mammordica charantia, and it is called up in many medical texts, particularly natural medical texts, as having chemical constituents which do assist in controlling the elevation of blood sugar levels. It's a food, and it works, if you like, in a slow but realistic way. People that might question my comments on this can easily verify them by looking at the net and punching in bitter melon stroke, if you like, type 2 diabetes, and seeing the confident recognition of its potential in what will come up. It is eaten as a vegetable. I was introduced to it by some of my Indian patients years ago who showed me how to prepare the food, and in fact brought up on a couple of occasions some of the food based on bitter melon that they had prepared as a gift for me. I quite like it. But again, I say it is an acquired taste perhaps, but let me just say this. If used regularly as part of the diet, it will, without doubt, lead to some moderate reduction in blood sugar levels, to the extent that if it is taken seriously, a person using it as medicine, i.e. a functional food, should in fact mention it to their general practitioner, who may already have them on some form of medication. It is a slow-acting substance, but it definitely will have some impact on the level of blood sugar. In fact, I see it as, if you like, the leading herb to be used for addressing certainly the early stages of type 2 diabetes. But let me just say again, type 2 diabetes is a medical condition and, in my opinion, should be monitored very well by the GP, who's our first-line therapist, and he will be able, as well as the patient will be able, to note the improvement in blood sugar levels, particularly if they're taking their blood sugar level at home, as I recommend my patients to do. Take your blood sugar regularly, levels regularly, and you can see the progressive movement downwards just by appending the daily use of bitter melon, Mammordica charantia. Overseas, it's also used as a juice. But ideally, despite the fact that it can these days, yes, wait for it, be prepared as a tablet or a capsule, the food, it is a food, let me emphasise, it is a food, and eaten as a food, in my opinion, you're likely to get better value and perhaps a better effect. So when we talk about a functional food, for diabetes type 2 as a food alongside of what has been prescribed or helping stop the drift to stronger levels of medication, the first port of call is bitter melon in whatever form, but ideally a food which we can get from our supermarkets.
Okay, well, we'll continue our our topic on functional foods very shortly. And, yeah, you're on fire today, Dennis.
Well, it's an interesting topic, isn't it?
You are.
I did a bit of preliminary reading and I was looking at some of the references that I used years ago when I taught this topic to my school, where we did a topic entitled Food Therapy. In fact, I'm thinking of running a program in that again, although, no, I've given my lecture days up. No, I retreat that.
Well, while you're thinking about got Cherie from Duns Creek on the line. Hi, Cherie. Thanks for holding.
No problems at all. How are you guys going?
Good, thank you. You've got issues with the urinary tract infections.
No, yes. Yes. I'm sick of antibiotics.
Yes.
Over the last 3 to 6 months, it's becoming more frequent for me.
Oh, dear.
I do drink quite a lot of water.
Yes.
do drink alcohol as well, mm-hmm. so I do understand that there's a dehydration factor of it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's becoming more frequent, and as people know with a urinary infection, it is painful beyond belief.
Of course. Look, what I'll do for you, Cherie, is make a few recommendations, some of which you may know about, but I recommend them certainly to listeners and to my patients. A good starting base these days is to use one of the newer supplements known as D-mannose, D-mannose, M-A-N-O-S-E. It's a powdered preparation, although you can get it in different forms. I recommend it to be used basically as a powdered preparation and taken prophylactically or preventatively in a very low dose. It's a very economic product to take. It builds up, if you like, a degree of prophylaxis against urinary tract infection. The theory is that what it does is interfere with the, how can I call it, the feeding ground on the urinary
yep.
tract that bacteria depend upon. So that's a starting
yep.
base. If you go onto it, there are instructions on what sort of amount to take depending upon whether it is a chronic or an active infection. But I see it ideally used not to treat the acute phase, but to seek to stop the infections occurring. So first up, you should do go to your pharmacy. I'm sure they would have it. If not, it's readily purchased from health food stores. It's a common supplement now, and there are many articles on it defending its use and its recent discovery. Principle number one. The second thing is, and you've probably used it, but if you're not using enough of it, it won't help. You need to get on some cranberry juice and take that regularly. I believe the juice is the best bet. I know, and I've prescribed it myself, you can get cranberry capsules and supplements, and some people do well on them, but the reputation for cranberry juice was based actually on the juice itself, not, if you like, other derivatives of it, and used again as an ongoing supplement to build up an environment of resistance to infection. It would work
yep.
well with D-mannose. I would see those as two frontline attempts to control the condition. However, you probably need something a little bit more antimicrobial that will actually deal with the presence of infection if it is there. And the herb
yep.
buku, B-U-C-H-U, buku. Now, buku was probably one of the mainline urinary tract medications prior to the Second World War. It's called up in the various editions of the British Pharmaceutical Codex, of the British Pharmacopoeia, and it had a great reputation then. Like many natural drugs or natural medicines, subsequent to the Second World War, sophistication came in, medications in their form changed, pharmaceuticals became more dominant, natural medicine and the traditional benefit of them became lost. Buku has an outstanding antibacterial or antimicrobial capacity to help in actually fighting an active infection. And I consider
awesome.
I consider it to be next to the herb known as bearberry, B-E-A-R-B-E-R-R-Y, bearberry, sometimes known as uveursi by herbalists. Though that herb, in conjunction with buku as a combination, is, in my opinion, one of the remaining remedies, unfortunately forgotten even by many herbalists, as a sincere way of addressing an active infection. I think if you go down that pathway of trying to develop prophylaxis with DMNOs and cranberry, very economic substances, and then have on hand a buku with Uveirce or Uveirce or buku on their own to deal with an active infection, if you don't get some benefit from that, I'd be very surprised, Cherie.
Excellent. No, thank you. Anything's better than nothing at the moment.
I understand.
Many years of dealing with this rubbish, I'm over it.
Yes, well, look, give it a go, because in my many years of practice, this is a condition that I have frequently dealt with and have been able to help many women. And But start off with that.
Thanks, awesome. Cherie.
Thank you so very much.
It's a pleasure.
And we've got Donna on the line from West Walls End. Thanks for holding, Donna.
Thank you.
How can we help you?
Hi, Dennis. How are you going?
I'm very well, Donna. Nice for you to ring.
Thank you. I've been diagnosed with T-cell lymphoma, and now I have psoriasis as well. So I was just wondering what else I could put that's natural onto my skin for both of those.
Okay. First of all, your T-cell lymphoma, rightly, is something that is treatable and must be treated by your doctors, your GP and a specialist. I suspect you're under management for that, are you?
Yes, I am.
Good. It's something that can only be managed medically. Let me emphasise that. Now, with reference to psoriasis, many listeners may or don't know what psoriasis is, but psoriasis is a stubborn skin condition which manifests itself typically on knees and elbows, although it can spread to many other parts of the body, and it's characterised by a scaly state of the skin, and it's very, very difficult to manage. Are you using presently anything on it, either topically or orally, to address it?
Yes, so I have spoken to you before,
yes.
And I do take primrose oil, and I have a prescription spray. It's like a mousse. That helps as well. I have had 4 biopsies in the last 2 months.
Yes.
As well. So they're both coming back as psoriasis and the T-cell lymphoma. But I wasn't sure if you could get both at the same time.
Look, you're getting into a fairly deep medical level. I'm not really competent to talk on that. It may be that there is a connection that the psoriasis, which is an autoimmune condition, may in fact be a consequence of the therapy you're having. You should discuss that with your medical managers. But look, is it restricted to any particular parts of your body?
It's only on my arm. And my leg.
Okay. And it's on the elbows and the knees?
Yes, on the knees. Yeah. Just around the elbow area.
Yes.
But it's on all up the leg.
Okay.
No, and arms nowhere. I was in my hair.
Yes.
But it's that's all sorted.
It's retreated from there. Look, the first thing I'd suggest is that I'm a fan of the old-style topical applications for this condition. And I think a pine tar-based ointment would be a good starting base.
Okay.
I started with creams, ointments based on pine tar and juniper tar, and I believe they're still an effective, economical way and very safe way, in my opinion, of treating something that is a limited level of the condition. That way you're not, if it's so limited, the topical application of a tar-based product, particularly pine tar, if your pharmacist can make it for you. The old formulas are still there, not difficult to do. Pine tar or juniper tar, I still consider them to be very good and safe way for treating limited levels of psoriasis, particularly in the locations where you're talking about. I would still suggest that you pursue your use of the primrose oil. You have to take it in a significant quantity. There's a bit of evidence to suggest that primrose oil does have some impact on autoimmune skin diseases, so work with it. I think it's a good supplement. But outside of that, I'd be reluctant to recommend anything orally because you'd have to make sure that that didn't clash with what you were being given by your medical managers. In the Pharmacopeia, for instance, which I work with, the 1983 edition of the British Herbal Pharmacopeia, interestingly, the herb of great choice there and great confidence is known as sarsaparilla. Now, people know sarsaparilla as a drink, but sarsaparilla is actually a herb. It's botanically known as smilax and used as oral medication, usually as a fluid extract. It's been a favourite remedy for herbalists trained in the Western system of herbalism, as I've been trained in, where when it's persevered with in the right dose, it can frequently undo even rampant psoriasis. But it is something that you would have to clear because you should not take anything from complementary medicine and from anywhere unless you have it cleared with your medical manager. But the two things, pine tar topically applied as an ointment and discuss the ongoing use of the extract of psoriasis. I'm sorry, not the extract of psoriasis, the extract of sarsaparilla.
How do you spell that?
P. You've made me laugh now. Sarsaparilla, S-A-R-S-A-P-A-R-I-L-L-A, sarsaparilla. But don't you say to your doctors that Dennis Stewart wants me to take this. Mention the fact that Dennis Stewart said that in the references that he works with, good British references, sarsaparilla is a herb of choice as oral medication to be used by a professional and monitored, particularly where the person is being treated with other substances.
Yeah.
Thanks for your call, Donna, and all the best with it.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Next we have on the line Terry from Blackalls Park. Hi, Terry. Thank you for holding.
Hello.
How can we help you?
Oh, that's okay. Hello. I listened to your program last week.
Yes.
And you were talking about slippery elm powder.
Yes.
But I missed a fair bit of it. I was just wanting to know, I have a big problem with irritable bowel syndrome.
Yes.
Does that help with that?
Okay. Slippery elm, first of all, for the sake of listeners, I will explain it, is the bark, or slippery elm powder, is the bark of the American tree known as slippery elm, and it contains constituents in it which have a number of useful properties for dealing with gut conditions, particularly for the bowel. One of the properties is that it is a very soothing agent, particularly where there's any inflammatory activity occurring. So it is sometimes used as support remedy for more serious bowel conditions such as ulcerative colitis. But other things about it is this, that it tends to have a regulating effect on transit time through the gut. In other words, where there is a diarrheic tendency or a constipational tendency, the taking of slippery elm can address either end of the problem. And taken as a regular supplement, it's readily available, by the way, and relatively cheap. Taken as an ongoing supplement, in my opinion, it is one of the most useful devices for dealing with that aspect of irritable bowel, which is characterised by irregularity of bowel function and a drift between a diarrhoea and constipation. Taken in a powdered form, a heap teaspoonful, a couple of times a day would be worthwhile trying. If it's stubborn, you obviously need to see someone, a therapist, a pharmacist, a herbalist, or a naturopath to look more closely at the dosage. But I would suggest the starting of a teaspoonful of slippery elm powder might be some use for irritable bowel syndrome, which, as I've said, can take on many characteristics.
Yes, because I have tended to take gastrostopper.
Yes.
And
yes.
I know that that's most probably not good to take in the long term.
Mm-hmm. Well, obviously, you have to take it if you have to take it. It certainly has its place, and it can stop some embarrassment. But the use of slippery elm powder might just give you that edge for better bowel control, which might lessen your need to depend upon any medication.
Okay, yeah, well, I'll give it a try. And you said twice a day.
Well, a teaspoonful a couple of times a day, that's a fairly low dose. And if it's going to do anything, it should reflect itself fairly promptly.
Okay, well, that sounds very good.
Well, see how you go, Terry. See how you go.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Pleasure.
Thanks, Terry. Okay. Got Roz from Maitland on the line. Hi, Roz. You want a supplement for fluid in the legs?
Yes. Yeah, if there's something that she could take.
Roz, this is for you, is it?
Yes, it is.
Okay. You obviously have had this condition looked at, have you?
I have.
Okay.
Yeah.
The only reason I say that is, for the sake of listeners, that fluid in the legs can indicate more serious levels of disease than just fluid, if you like. It can be associated with kidney problems, with circulatory problems. But sometimes it can be, if you like, just idiopathic, just related to the person, with the cause being somewhat difficult to resolve. Tell us something about your fluid in your legs. Is it all your legs, or is it just around your ankles?
It's more from my knees down.
Okay.
And around the ankles and into the foot. So had surgery on a knee.
Okay.
And it has been a bit more prominent, but it was there before.
Okay. Are you using compression bandages or anything like that?
No, I'm not. I have tried those.
And they didn't do anything for you?
No, they really didn't do anything.
Okay. Does your fluid subside when you go to bed or lay down or put your feet up?
It tends to, but as soon as you go back upright, it's there again.
Are you on many medications?
I'm on thyroid medication and blood thinners and a heart rhythm medication.
Okay. Have you run that past your GP or your pharmacist to see if there's anything?
I have, because I've tried the fluid tablets, which aren't ideal with those.
Yes.
So I just wondered if there was something. Like, I know celery is quite a good diuretic, but I just didn't know if there was anything else that you could take.
I think that one of the things I'd recommend here is that not just something that is going to function as an alternative diuretic, useful as that might be, I would suggest you be looking at herbs like, for instance, horse chestnut, which is a much stronger medicinal herb used for circulatory problems. Associated particularly with lymphatic functioning. That would be one that I would go to. Also, a favourite American herb that I use a lot but isn't a popular over-the-counter preparation is the American herb known as prickly ash. Now, those two herbs, you can Google them, have a relationship to circulatory problems and fluid build-up. So I would look at those now and as a starting base, put it that way.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Okay,
Ross.
Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Bye. Okay, bye. We've got another leg issue. Pauline from Newcastle East. You've got itchy, dry lower legs.
Yes. Yes. So much that sometimes I blood, you know.
You scratch so much.
Little droplet.
Yes, dear. Pauline, have you got a dermatitis or an eczema?
I've got very pale and dry skin.
Yes, but not associated with any disease. It's just you.
And I've inherited from my mother. She has the same thing.
Yes,
and she was telling an uncle in Tassie, and he said, "Oh, my mate so and so's got that." He said, "I'll give him a ring." And this was a priest, and I rang another priest, and he rang Mum and said, "Margaret," he said, "had the same thing. Stop eating oranges, and take," and it was a mineral thing, something phosphate. And of course, I didn't note it, but as I've got older, my dear Mum passed, is gone. You know, she passed away.
Okay.
And as I've got older, I've got more itchier.
Okay.
The GP did. Who works is for a skin clinic.
Yes.
In Charlestown, and yes. he's given me scripts for it's called salicylate.
Yes.
And something and aqueous 4%.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a fairly well known, older fashioned preparation that is still useful. And I would not be opposed to your using that. But what I would suggest is that what you need to do is supplement your diet with what are called essential fatty acids, which come best in substances like oil of evening primrose. Oil of evening primrose is one of my most favourite preparations for most skin conditions characterised by itch and dryness, usually, however, associated with a dermatitis or an eczema. But if I were you, I'd make a beeline for your pharmacist, get hold of some oil of evening primrose capsules and take to start with three of those orally a day. And interestingly, what you could also do with that, you can buy the oil separately in a container or bottle. And what you can do is, in fact, massage that onto the legs. That can sometimes work remarkably well. In fact, for children for whom taking capsules is not appropriate, recommendations in the literature have been to actually apply it topically, and it seems to work well for kids' conditions. Why not try that? It's harmless, it has a good reputation, and it will oil up your skin, so to speak, and at the same time, maybe bring with it an anti-itch characteristic. That would be my suggestion. Your doctor's on the right track. I have no objection to that. But taking primrose oil orally and perhaps using it experimentally, perhaps, as a topical agent massaged into your dry legs.
Good luck with that, Pauline. Hopefully you have some luck. Yeah, let us know how you go. Dennis, we've got about a minute left, and we were going to talk about gout.
We were going to talk about another topic.
Well,
you misread my...
I did. I misread your notes, and I thought it said government is a painful condition experienced by many people.
It is a very, very truthful statement, which I could talk about for hours, having studied politics at university. But what you should read is that gout is a painful condition, not government. But you said the right stuff.
But so. Government can be a painful condition, so, you know.
I would say typically so. But we're going to talk about gout, but we're pretty well struck for time.
We are. So, we can't talk about gout, we can't talk about government, and we definitely can't talk about processed foods because that will
a very purist day today. I'm a bit wound up, but when you said government is a painful condition, I couldn't let that go without commenting. See, that's my writing, listeners.
It is.
She hasn't learned to interpret it yet, but she's getting close to it.
I'm doing my best. Doing my best.
Well, we'll talk about it next week.
We shall do. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to this podcast from 2NURFM at the University of Newcastle. Topics range from gardening to health, well-being, pet care, and travel. You'll find them all at 2NURFM.com.